Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you, Wes?
I'm good. I'm a little tired, getting off my run of volunteering for a community theater show, but feeling good. I know I got lots of gaming ahead of me, you know?
Yeah. Well, have you had time to play any games this week?
A little bit, yeah. And for once, I am staying on the same game that I talked about last week. I have just been deep diving into Divinity Original Sin 2, trying to get it done before Baldur's Gate 3 comes out. And I'm very quickly running out of time. Every time that I think, okay, this act is going to be the last big area that I have to explore, I'm wrong.
yeah.
Because there's the intro area, Fort Joy, and then you go to Reaper Coast, which is huge. And then there's two areas after that. As far as I know, there could be more. And they're a little smaller, but still, like, the map size may be a little smaller, but then there's tons of underground areas and, like, caves and dungeons and stuff to explore. It's a lot. I'm going to have to start skipping some side quests, but I don't know if I have it in me to do that. But the nice thing is I have been able to start wrapping up one by one some of my party's storylines, because I picked all origin characters, which are like predetermined characters with a story in Divinity. And all of them have these story quests that they can go through. And I got to finally complete two of those, which just feels so good after having this game on the back burner for years and just being like, I don't really know what happens to any of these characters. but there is some really fun stuff with the characters. They're all really interesting, and you get to do pretty like world-shaking stuff. Like, it's not like small stuff. You're dealing in gods and big changes to the world with your character arcs, which is always fun because you can really get a grand scale of things. And I don't want to spoil too much, but the Red Prince's story was really fun. The one who I played and gave me a fun summon that I can use for the rest of the game, which is perfect because I ended up specking into Summoner without even realizing it would be helpful for me.
Nice.
But yeah, it's just so fun. And I love all the mechanics it has for combat. And from what I've seen of Baldur's Gate 3, it looks like it's that plus more. So I'm going to be overwhelmed by the amount of things I can do in combat, I'm sure. But it's just such a fun playground, having all those options and all these ways to solve problems and all these ways you can build your party. No one's run is exactly like anyone else's because you have so many skills you can spec into. And it's just really feeding the hype for me. I'm feeling ready for Baldur's Gate 3. Even though they have origin characters in Baldur's Gate 3, I'm going to play as a custom character for my first time through, just because it's a D&D universe, and being able to like create my D&D character or a D&D character that I want to make and spend hours in the character creator sounds awesome to me. So I still have a little bit left. I'm very close to the end. Hopefully I'm going to be able to finish it before Baldur's Gate comes out, but if not, at least I've made it much further than I have before. Yeah, and
all right.
That's pretty much what I've been up to and what I will be up to for a while, I'm sure. But what about you? What have you been playing recently?
Well, Wes, I've been playing Guild Wars 2, and I have to say, last week I was singing its praises, but this week I'm mad.
Oh, boy.
I'm really mad. I'm furious.
Tell me why.
All I wanted to do was beat the story before today's episode, and I couldn't do it. And you know why I couldn't do it, Wes? It wasn't because I wasn't good enough or I did the talent trees wrong. It was because it kept disconnecting me from the game.
Oh, no.
And whenever you get disconnected from a story mission, you have to restart it from the beginning. Some of these story missions are over a half an hour long.
Yikes.
And I probably spent 2 or 3 hours replaying the same missions over and over, praying it would not disconnect, and it always would disconnect. And I still haven't beaten it, even though I think I'm on the last mission. And this is an issue that has been going on in the game since I found threads dating all the way back through like 2017, and it's just never been fixed. And people still complain about it to this day. And they have to fix this, man. It's like so bad.
That's crazy. So it's something server side then that is just like kicking people randomly?
Yeah. Yeah. It only happens on cinematic cutscenes. From what I've read, it has to do with it's rendering differently or uses more CPU power or something. But the cutscenes are not skippable, so I'm literally at the mercy of the cutscene.
Oh, no.
I can't do anything about it. And it's crazy. People have said, you know, like, make sure your internet's good. Load up a video on YouTube and have it play in the background so you know if you have an interruption or something. And, you know, no interruptions. And the gameplay outside of these story missions is so smooth. Never had an issue. I'm running, like, 120 FPS at all times, even on, like, good settings. But in these cutscenes, there's a bug or something, and it just crashes pretty much.
Oh, no.
So that's awful. And, you know, it's made me in such a bad mood, Wes. I just have to keep the bad news coming with this game, because after playing it for another few weeks, I'm kind of starting to realize some of the things I don't like about it as much.
The honeymoon phase is over.
Yeah. And, you know, like, one thing that I didn't really realize I didn't like it, like, I knew something was off, but I couldn't really put my finger on it, and that's that the voice acting is not good. And it's not just like the voices themselves, it's the fact that a lot of the races in the game look very almost alien like to me, or like very very beast like and they talk like, hey, how's it going, man? And
right.
You're like, you just do a double take. It's like, imagine like E.T. just being like, hey, how's it going, man? It'd be so weird.
Yeah.
Or like Yoda, like just speaking like in a normal voice. It doesn't work for me. And there's something like off-putting about it. Just be like, why aren't you talking like an alien? It's so weird. Like, it's obviously that's all made up anyway.
Right, but sure.
I don't know. I was thinking like, you know, I can watch like Marvel movies and they don't really do that too much. Right? They kind of sound like normal people. I think of like Rocket Raccoon or something, but maybe that's because they're like anthropomorphized. I don't know.
Right.
But in this game, it just feels like I'm looking at Jar Jar Binks and he's like, hey, how's it going, dude?
Right.
Well, I feel like this is weird.
There definitely is something to be said for, like, you know, you're trying to get yourself lost in this world. You're trying to suspend your disbelief of all these crazy races and stuff like that. And it helps keep you in that world if there's like a vocal representation of their physicality, you know, like you were saying, like Jar Jar Binks, like he sort of has like a bill or a beak, and you know, that's kind of represented in the way he sort of like not quacks, but you know what I mean? Like the way his voice goes. So I totally get that. You know, you don't want it to be a caricature, like crazy weird noises just because it's a frog or something, but I could see that definitely pulling you out of it.
Yeah. I don't know. It just really did for me. And I think the story in general is not good. Like, it's good maybe compared to, like, WoW, which doesn't even have, like, a real story for, let's say, classic WoW. But if I were to compare it to, like, Final Fantasy XIV, it's, like, night and day difference. Like, Final Fantasy XIV is way, way better. And it's so weird, because in Guild Wars 2, you'll be introduced to characters, and then in that same mission, they'll die, and they're, like, trying to make you feel bad about it. It's like, I just met this person. Like, who is this person? Or, like, they'll bring somebody in and be like, this is the war general, and it'll be, like, a gnome. And you're like, how? Like, they're 2 feet tall. Like, I'm sorry, I just don't buy that they're the war general. I don't know. It's weird. The story just does not gel with me. And I heard it gets better in the expansions, but, you know, I'm not going to spend money on expansions if I can't even beat the first story because it crashes. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's been an issue. And then the other thing is the actual combat. You've got 10 skills, and 5 of them are specific to your weapon. The other 5, you've got 1 healing ability, 3 that are class specific, and then 1 ultimate ability, which means you barely use it. So out of the 10, there's only like 3 skills that feel like I'm playing my class. And the first 5 skills are like generic, in my case, longbow skills. And they don't really feel special. They just kind of feel like I'm shooting people with arrows.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, but there's nothing like I'm playing a hunter kind of ranger. Like, there's nothing like huntery about it. It feels very weird. And there's a weird situation that came up where I looted a unique item that was way better DPS, but it was a weapon that I could use, but I didn't want to use. But I felt like I had to because the DPS on it was way better. So I was just like playing this class where like 7 out of the 10 skills were kind of things that I couldn't really use or didn't want to use. Felt super weird. I much prefer it in like WoW where all the skills are related to your class. That really makes the class identity feel right. Better.
Yeah, definitely. And something like Final Fantasy 14 again, you know, there's times where I look at people's like people who are really good at the game and their screen is just littered with skill icons, but mm-hmm. there is a gradual progression to it. And the fact that they have combo skills and it all flows into each other and you have like a rhythm, a cycle of skills that you go through, I feel like it keeps it really interesting and definitely has that class identity.
Yeah. And I felt like that was missing on Guild Wars 2. So yeah, I don't know that I'll keep playing. Honestly, if I can't beat the story mission, I'm not going to play anymore. I'll just go to Final Fantasy, man. It's been making me want to go back there because I feel like pretty strongly like that's where the best MMO experience right now is.
Right.
I would say that, and oddly enough, RuneScape, school RuneScape. Yeah. But it's kind of sad because I think there's a lot of really nice like new player things and like ease of access things that the game has, and it looks good. You know, there's voice acting, there's cutscenes, but I don't know. It just doesn't deliver on the quality that I'm looking for that I've seen in Final Fantasy. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know that I'll keep playing. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, that's a shame. I mean, hopefully you'll get a chance to at least beat the story. But if it's that painful, yeah, I think it's time maybe to put it down and walk away.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's another company that's kind of walking away that we're going to talk about.
Fantastic for transition. Our special
topic. Thank you. Ohio Scientific. Have you ever heard of them, Wes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They've made a couple computers. We often call them OSI.
Yeah, they're going to be getting sold here and not really making computers anymore. We will still play games from other people for their computers for a while. But Ohio Scientific itself, not going to be really around anymore.
Yeah, so let's start off, kind of go over their general history and see what led to them being sold. So Ohio Scientific was founded in 1975, so really not that long ago in video game history, in Hiram, Ohio, by Dale Dreisbach and Charity and Mike Cheeky, or Cheeky, I don't know how to say their name. And they started out by making electronic teaching equipment, and just kind of like calculators of various things like that, but it really wasn't doing well. But one product that they made, which was a microcomputer training board, really took off. So they just transitioned to microcomputers and started making some of the computers that we know about. And because they transitioned to microcomputers, this actually made one of the founders, Charity Cheeky, the first woman to be helping lead a computer manufacturing company. So pretty cool, but unfortunate since we do know that this company isn't going to be around for too long. But Ohio Scientific grew very fast over the next few years. They had 35 employees in January of 1978 and were moving to a bigger facility. And then 6 months later, they had 100 employees. So they were really starting to gain steam and sell some computers. And they were growing fast enough that the Cheekys were having trouble managing the company as it grew, and OSI was also having trouble keeping up with its software and hardware distribution. I think there was one New York computer store owner who just said they'd be a great company if they could actually deliver on all the stuff that they make, or something along those lines, because they had a lot of great ideas and a lot of great products, but they just didn't really have the distribution or the infrastructure for it. And because they didn't have much software, they actually did something similar to APX that we talked about recently, where they kind of created a program to encourage users to create software so that they could really fill out their software catalog. But even then, it still didn't really meet their needs. They still didn't have all the software that they wanted. And so as this was going on, moving into 1980, the Cheekys kind of wanted out of the company. There was difficulties with it. They felt like they couldn't manage it effectively anymore. So they talked to a business partner of theirs and made an arrangement to have it sold to a telecommunications company from Massachusetts called MACOM. And the company went through a lot of structural changes after MACOM took over. And eventually in late 1981, it's going to be renamed to MACOM Office Systems instead of Ohio Scientific. And apparently a year later, when asked about the name change, one of the executives of the company said, well, this is not an Ohio or a scientific company anymore. Because wow. At that point, I don't think it was based in Ohio anymore. And they were working on totally different telecommunications stuff. So, you know, people still have the Ohio Scientific computers. So like Ben was saying, we are still going to see some games being developed for them. But as far as new computers coming out, the ones that you're going to mention, Ben, are pretty much it.
All right. So let's mention some of those. Their line of computers was really complicated, honestly. They had a lot of them. The naming system was awful. They had like, you know, computer one and then computer two and then computer one series two and computer three and then computer two series two. Oh, no. It was like very complicated. In fact, on their like catalog, they have like a giant chart with like check marks, like showcasing all the computers and what they could do and what they can't do. I think in general, their computers were always most marketable towards that hobbyist because they sold just the boards, right? I think they were pretty popular with that.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, they didn't have software for like a normal non-computer person. So they could never really be marketable to that average home computer user in the same way that Apple II was able to do or the Atari 8-bit or something. So I think that's partially the reason why they had to get out of the business. They couldn't really expand even more, or their you know, the company that bought them out chose not to continue to expand the business. I think that might have been one of the reasons. But as far as the old computers go, as I mentioned, they had this line of computers called the Challenger line. They also had just, they would have like a model numbers and another series called the Superboard computers. The last few that came out, because I think we mentioned the earlier ones in an earlier special topic, maybe like a year or two ago. But some of the later ones that we haven't mentioned included the Challenger 4P and the Challenger 3. So already I'm getting confused with the names. Each of those had kind of like sub-designs. So like the Challenger 3 had like the 3A, the 3B, the 3C, and so on. I thought one of the coolest ones that they had was the Challenger 3P. And this one was interesting, I thought, because it was a computer that had three chips in it. It had three CPUs. It had a 6502, a 6800, and a Z80 all in the same computer. Which I don't know why you would ever need that, but okay. It was meant to be a very high-end computer, this Challenger 3P. It had floppy disk support. It had a hard drive, which is extremely rare at this time of history to have a hard drive. Or, I'm sorry, not a hard drive, a disk drive.
Yeah.
So that was pretty rare. It had a lot of RAM, but it never, like, they never really had computers that did graphics well. All their computers, I think, were always in black and white. The resolution was never great. They were more for mathematical functions and for hobbyists, and they were trying to target that business sector as well, but never really was able to do so. So I thought that one was kind of a fun computer, and then one of their other last ones was called the Challenger 4P, and this one, I don't know, it had like BASIC installed on it. I think it could do CPM. They're supposed to be like decent computers from what I understand, but they just were never able to get them out to people, I guess, or convince people that they should get this over maybe a more user-friendly computer. So, yeah, so those were some of the last ones. They came out in 1979 and 1980. I don't think there were any computers that came out in 81 or after. So that will be the last new computer we hear from Ohio Scientific, but of course it will be new software and we will check out those games if they're good enough, but they are black and white, so we'll see. All right, with that being said though,
yeah, why don't we take a little break and then get into our timeline and talk about some games. We'll be right back.
Hello and welcome back. Let's hop into it today with my first review of the day. It's the big one again. I feel like, man, last week was Scramble, this time Mayday. And if you guys aren't familiar with Mayday, I'm not too surprised because it's a Defender clone, and Williams immediately sued Hoei, who made Mayday, and I don't think it was around too long. But obviously, they just straight up took like a Defender machine and just changed a few things. Like the laser beam that shoots off of the ship is exactly the same as Defender. Man. And that's such an iconic part. Like, I feel like you'd have to change that if you were going to clone this. But, you know, there's a lot of things that remind me of Defender, just the overall visual kind of style and the way things blow up into a million pieces. All those things are still here and they look great. But they did do a fair amount of gameplay changes as well, which I was not expecting. And so I decided to check it out. I think the number one thing that they changed is that there's like more than one level. Because isn't Defender, isn't it kind of always the same, or am I thinking incorrectly?
I believe it's always the same, but there are different waves that come at you. But I think you're always on the same level, yeah.
So in the original Defender, you had a ground, like that was mountainous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was there a ceiling? I don't think there was a ceiling.
There was a ceiling, yes.
There was a ceiling. So in this game, you've got sometimes that situation where you're kind of like in a cave and you've got a ceiling and a ground. Sometimes you're in quote-unquote space and there's neither of those things. Sometimes there's only a ground. And in a few of the stages, you're like fighting over the sea. So it kind of looks like there's waves in the middle of the screen, and then there's submarines under the waves that you're shooting down. And actually in those waves, instead of your main shot shooting straight in front of you, it actually fires at a 45 degree angle down. So that was kind of interesting, like you're firing down into the waves. So I liked that a lot. The stages, they had that kind of looping, wrapping mechanic, but then once the stage was over, somehow without going through a loading screen, it would transition you to the next level, which was really cool. Was not expecting that at all. So there's levels in this game. There's, I think, 8 different stages, but I think like the backgrounds repeat, and there's really only like 4. I don't know why there's 8. But you've got that going on, which is kind of cool. In the quote-unquote space stages, there's even like a kind of starry background sky, and in some of the other ones, there's not. So they try to have some distinctions there. But there's also some other weird gameplay changes that I'm not as much of a fan of, or that it just seems weird to me. But for example, in the original game, you had, I think, a turnaround button, but you could also fly backwards, right? Or did you have to turn around?
I believe you had to turn around, but you carried, like, inertia. So if you did a quick turn, you could fly backwards, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this game, you cannot turn around at all. You only fly in one direction, but it's still like Defender controls. Like, it's not a constantly scrolling screen, so you can control how fast you fly to the right and have that screen wrap. But to kind of compensate for the fact that enemies can come up behind you still, because they can still move in two directions, they give you a fire button from like the rear of your ship, so you can fire directly behind you, which is kind of weird, but I guess it works. I was like, why did they change that? I feel like you could have just had the player turn around, but maybe it was just hard-coded in Defender, and they just were like, we can't figure this part out, so just give you the fire behind you button. And then another thing is, like, the main part of Defender is you're trying to save civilians, right, before they become invaders. And in this game, the civilians do become, like, enemy aliens if they're left alone. There's no spacecraft like trying to take them away. They just kind of float around the level. And in order to progress to the next stage, you have to clear them. So the game is encouraging you to shoot the civilians. So that was pretty weird, but it kind of works, I guess. Some of the other small changes they made, some of the enemies, when you hit them, break off into a lot of smaller enemies, which were very annoying to play against, but it's cool, I guess. They have a few other different kinds of enemies. As I mentioned, there's subs in the one sub stage. You have some ships that just look straight up like TIE fighters. You still have the clear screen bomb, I think. I think the original Defender had that.
Yeah.
So you still have that. So In a lot of ways, it's similar. You still have inertia like you did in the original Defender. You just can't turn around. So there's a lot of stuff that reminds me of Defender because I'm sure it's just like straight up stolen from Defender. But there's some weird gameplay changes that I don't know that they needed to change, but they did.
Right, yeah.
And like some things that I really do like fighting submarines. That's cool. I like that. But yeah, some of these other gameplay things I'm not as much of a fan with. So I think that's pretty much everything that's different from Defender. So I'll go into my ratings. For gameplay, I ended up giving it a 3.5 out of 10. I know you mentioned Defender was really hard. Man, this game's super hard again. I struggled with Scramble, and I struggled with this game. I only got to the second stage once after probably 4 or 5 times of playing it. I kept dying because I would pass ships, and they would come up behind me. And your ship is situated not in the middle of the screen like in Defender, but kind of like between the middle and the left edge, like halfway between that. So you really don't get much time if somebody comes in from the left edge behind you.
Oh, yeah.
I think maybe you're encouraged to move through the maze at a certain speed to kind of pass enemy ships, and they can't catch up with you because they don't move that fast and you don't have that problem. But then it's really hard to see what's coming up in front of you because you're moving fast. So I'm not saying like I couldn't get good at the game, but it felt like just really hard. And I know Defender is really hard, so I'm not sure if this would be easier or harder than Defender, but just looking at the videos, this one looks a lot harder to me just because like when a ship breaks off into a bunch of smaller ships, it's like 8 smaller ships. Like it's so many. And like when the submarines come, they're in a pack of probably 8 submarines and they all fire a volley at you at the same time. And you can't shoot straight down at them. They have a shot that goes straight up. So you have to like try to get them in front of you because you have a 45 degree angle shot. I don't know. I just felt it was really hard. So that definitely hurt the enjoyment of it a little bit. But then some of the other things, as I mentioned, constantly getting hit from behind is super annoying. And there were times I thought I had cleared everything and there was like a human left. And I was like, I guess I have to kill this human to get to the next wave. That was weird. It's weird that you have a shot that shoots backwards when only probably a quarter of the screen is behind you. This feels weird. Like, how do you know? You do have the radar on the top of the screen, so you can maybe use that to know what's off screen, but that's still a weird mechanic in my opinion. And the biggest thing about the gameplay that I think makes it worse than Defender is that there were noticeable lag spikes when a certain amount of enemies were on screen. So I don't know if Defender was just playing with all the resources that it could, you know, like if it had one more enemy, it would start the lag. But this definitely added a lot of enemies, and it definitely lags when there's a lot of stuff on screen. So I couldn't give it as high as Defender, but there are a lot of things I really like about the game, like the multiple levels, the differences in enemy design, and just shooting things is fun. So I didn't go too low, but 3.5 out of 10 is where I ended up. For graphics, I ended up giving that 3.75 out of 10. I don't think it looks quite as good as Defender. The ship design is one thing that has changed, and I like the ship of the original Defender, although it does keep the exhaust at the back of the ship the same. And I don't know, in Defender, Wes, maybe you can remember this, but I feel like in Defender you could shoot as many times as you wanted.
I think so, yeah.
But in this game you're limited to 3 shots on screen at a time, which wouldn't be a huge issue if they were really quick like they are in Defender. But because the game can lag, sometimes it can take a second. And I think just the overall design of the world wasn't quite as good. Like there's something uniquely spacey about Defender's design, and taking it and putting it in like a sea theme or something doesn't work quite as well because it feels like you're shooting laser beams.
Right.
And, yeah. I don't know. So I think the design, what they did change was mostly negatives, I think, whereas what they kept were the things that were my favorite. So I ended up going down to 3.75. They're still quite good, though, because there are a lot of things from Defender still here, and everything related to Defender looks amazing. For sound effects, I just gave that a 2.5 out of 10. They're very generic, kind of spacey sound effects. I'm not sure how many are ripped from Defender, to be honest. I would imagine most of them are, but I could be wrong. But there wasn't anything really special. I didn't hear any music or anything like that. For relevance, I gave that a 5 out of 10. I want to say it's relevant because it's one of the first clones and it did make a fair amount of changes, but it did get sued out of existence, so I don't know how many people saw it. So I ended up going just down the middle with a 5. And overall, I gave it a 3.25 out of 10. It's quite good, you know, especially we've been playing so many Galaxian-style games, so it is nice for me to play one of these Defender games. I think I'm going to look forward to these for quite a while. But it's not as good as the original Defender. I think they had some good ideas, but they had so many ideas, and they all didn't work. Some of them worked, and there were definitely some misses. So
yeah.
I think overall, Defender is just a better packaged, play-tested product, and this one feels a little random at times. So didn't go quite as high.
That's interesting. Yeah, they did do some different stuff, which is good. They're not just a direct ripoff, although it's definitely close enough that, as you mentioned, they're going to get into some legal trouble. But yeah, it just kind of highlights how solid Defender was. Like, it did a lot of stuff right off the bat, and try to tweak those things to be different doesn't always necessarily work.
Yeah, I think it's just something about the overall package of Defender. It feels like all the mechanics really complement each other.
Right.
And here, it felt like some of the mechanics were kind of fighting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a laser beam that shoots out my back, but I can't see out my back. So what's the point of that?
Right.
Stuff like that. So
interesting. Oh, cool. Still a neat one to take a look at. And we do, of course, have some clones of Mayday, so who knows what happened to these after Mayday was sued, or OA was sued for this, but we have Mayday by Karateco and Battlezone by Video Games Limited.
Yep, and moving on, we've got another one here called Tunnel Hunt. This one's by Century, kind of, because it was actually developed by a guy named Owen Rubin at Atari. He developed it in 1979. But Atari never ended up publishing it. I think they originally sold it to Exidy, who didn't end up using it, and then they sold it to Century, who did finally publish it in 1981. And as you can imagine, 1979 game coming out in 1981 doesn't look as good. So
yeah.
This is a turret gunning game. You've got that crosshair on the screen, and the main appeal of it is you're going through this like wormhole tunnel that constantly is changing colors, so it looks pretty psychedelic and it does look really cool, but that alone isn't really enough to compare it with these other games we're playing today.
Yeah, and if I remember right, it does have maybe even a little bit of Exidy influence. Like you mentioned, you're shooting down just basically like TIE fighters that look almost exactly like the Starfire Exidy TIE fighters. So as interesting visually as it was, not something we really wanted to review. But this next game was interesting and worth reviewing, and boy, does it have one heck of a name. It is Satan of Saturn by SNK.
Okay.
I just love that. I don't know. It gives me good vibes, you know? And all of the games that we are mentioning today did come out in March. Or we just put them in March because it made sense in the timeline, but we do know for sure that's when Satan of Saturn came out. As you would hope, it does have a great looking flyer for it. It's got space, some kind of moon base with biodomes on it, and then in the background, Saturn with some vampire looking dude's face just on Saturn. And I'm guessing maybe the theming is that you're literally like defending a moon base from Satan that lives on Saturn. I don't know, but that's kind of what I'm getting from it. And it did come in both upright and cocktail cabinet versions. But it is a Galaxian style game where you have 5 different waves of enemies to fight. You are at the bottom of the screen, like the classic style, and you can shoot as fast as you want, which is really nice. The first round is UFOs that sort of snake around the screen and shoot at you periodically and will try to fly down and run into you as well. And one of the extra mechanics in this game is that the area where your ship goes back and forth, you can deploy a barrier periodically that lasts for a little bit of time. And if you deploy that barrier when any of the UFOs are going to run into it or are already in it, they'll die that way too. So they kind of make it so there's, if you don't shoot all the enemies when they're coming down at first, you have to destroy them by using the barrier, because otherwise they'll sneak up under your ship and blow you up that way. The second round after the UFOs, based on the English release of this, or an un-English release of this, is missiles, but they shoot at you. So I don't really know what's going on there, if that was just a...
They're advanced missiles.
Yeah, a misinterpretation or what. But these are pretty interesting because it's something, a pattern that we haven't necessarily seen before in a Galaxian-style game. They just fly diagonally down in a group from one corner of the screen to the other. And I think they keep looping if you don't kill them. And very hard to hit because they kind of shoot straight down when they're over you as they're flying diagonally. So interesting kind of movement that we haven't seen before, but very tough. If you get past that round, you have like a giant asteroid. It seems like only one from what I've seen, but maybe there are more. But a big asteroid shows up, falls towards you. And as far as I could tell, it doesn't break into smaller pieces when you shoot it, which is kind of a bummer. So it's just like another obstacle to avoid. But then for the fourth round is when things get interesting. You get this screen that I think says mission to Saturn approved or something like that. And your ship at the bottom of the screen gets launched through space and lands on, I guess, Saturn, but it's a rocky planet. So maybe it's one of the moons. It's not very clear, but you land on a planet and your ship, instead of being a spaceship at the bottom of the screen, turns into a tank, and it operates exactly the same, fires exactly the same, but it's a cool little visual difference there that you're actually on a planet's surface now. And you have to fight these centipede monsters, which again, in the English translation, I think are called spiders, but they have like four sections to their body. So I don't know what's going on there, but they just kind of scurry all over the screen diagonally and back up and down a bunch, and they shoot groups of shots down at you that are shaped like circles. And then the fifth stage is that you have to fight these big dragonflies that move erratically around the screen. But once you hit them, you start over again and go through all the rounds again. Originally, we thought there was a boss fight in this, but after reading through the flyers and watching multiple people play the game and playing it myself, the dragonflies are the last boss or the last wave, and then it does start over again. So unfortunately, no big boss fight in this, really, except for the dragonflies. But that's the basic breakdown of the game. Let me get into my ratings now for it. For graphics, I gave it a 3.5 out of 10. Satan of Saturn has some nice bright colors. Everything is a multicolored sprite. But it just, for some reason, doesn't feel like it has the fidelity of some of the other games that we've seen recently. And I can't tell if this was just the emulation or not, but it also looked a little jittery at times. So while it had a lot of good colors and I like the player ship a lot, I like that it turns to the tank, and I like the like docking setup at the bottom of the screen, which basically looks like a big mothership or like a tiny part of one. It just looked a little blocky and a lot of flat colors. So something was kind of missing there. I did also really like though the planets in the background of the first three waves. They look really good. There's Saturn and some of its moons, and they have these nice purples and blues, and they kind of like shined and pulsated and got brighter and dimmer periodically as the round went on. So it was a nice bit of visual interest there. And then the planet side phase also does look pretty nice. It's got some cool looking craters, but I guess because they put so much detail into the craters, the whole background is black. It's just craters. So that was a little bit weird. There's like no ground there. And there's also some sort of strange alien base with a flashing doorway at the top of the screen, which looks pretty good. And I think out of all the enemies, I mean, the UFOs were pretty simple. The missiles looked a little weird. The centipede enemies are definitely my favorite. Lots of legs and multi-segmented, and they kind of look different as they go towards you and go away from you. They have a couple different sprites. So they look pretty cool, even though I don't think they look like spiders at all. Moving on to sounds, though, I gave it a 2.75 out of 10 here. We've got some of the classic spacey laser sounds that we're used to, and they all sound pretty good, just a little bit unoriginal. But then there's also just this weird, like, kind of high-pitched pulsing noise that's going on in the background that got on my nerves a bit, and also the lasers and the enemies were pretty high-pitched as well. So after playing this for a couple of minutes, I was turning the volume down pretty low. It was a bit much for me. But there was music in this, so I did have to give it some points for that. And it has a classic tune that I can't remember that plays whenever you die and respawn. But then when you launch the Saturn, it just straight up plays part of the Star Wars soundtrack. So
nice.
It, you know, the classic, like, da, 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 da. It just plays that when you launch the Saturn. So it's very weird, but you know, I love that music. So it was fun hearing that as you're getting launched towards the planet. I don't know for sure if they got away with that, if it went unnoticed or what, but it's pretty funny. For gameplay, I gotta say something about the gameplay here just didn't really click with me either. Satan of Saturn is super fast, and even though you can shoot very fast, it doesn't feel like your shots are always connecting for some reason. I think it might be because your shots cancel out enemy shots when you hit them, which is an interesting gameplay element, but it left me feeling like I couldn't dip in, take a shot, and duck away to get a kill because it would just cancel out the shot that was falling at me. And I would have to like stay there longer and end up getting hit. And I don't know if that was the main reason or not, but I was just having a lot of trouble with this game and going through the stages. I do like that there were all these different stages though, and they all felt, they all had their own feel to them. But overall, I mean, it is just stuff shooting at you and you shooting back at them. It's not like some other Galaxian games that we've seen where they have a docking section like we've seen, or dodging asteroids like Astro Blaster. So even though all the enemies moved differently and shot at you differently, it still kind of felt the same. And I feel like they made some really interesting enemy patterns here, like the missiles that go diagonally across the screen. But when they made those patterns, I don't know if they thought about how people would dodge them. It just seemed like it was looked cool, but was too hard. And again, I'm not great at this type of game, so that's part of it as well. But all that together left me to say, it was pretty fun, but I gave it a 2.5 out of 10 for gameplay. Moving on to relevance now, I gave it a 4 out of 10 here. Satan of Saturn is really hard to find information on, and while it did have a few clones and licensed copies, none of them were super popular either. I do like the fact that you changed to a land vehicle for the last two waves, but since the gameplay didn't really change with that, I don't think that in and of itself is super relevant, so I decided to give it a pretty low score there. But then overall, that left me with a 2.75 out of 10 for Satan of Saturn. Unfortunately, despite the fantastic name, it was just okay. I mean, it was pretty solid. It had some interesting visuals that were great in some places, but then also lacking in others. The audio just kind of annoyed me more than anything else, but I did really like the Star Wars tune in there. And the gameplay for me was just a little bit too fast and too brutal. So it's still definitely unique and has its own crazy vibe, and it's definitely worth taking a look at, but it just wasn't the best Galaxian type game that we've seen.
All right.
Yeah, so it was an interesting one. And I mean, with a name like that, I had to at least give it a shot, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a certain other Satan themed game that I know will come out in 81 that I'm really want to play. I know you really want to play Doom. I had to do double on that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But in the meantime, we've got some clones of the SNK game here that we wanted to mention. We've got Satan of Saturn by Ender, Satan of Saturn by Model Racing, and Zarzon by Taito, which I think was the official licensed version in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, had a couple clones. That was cool.
All right, but now we've got a pretty big honorable mention. Super Cobra by Konami does come out in March, and it is a follow-up to Scramble, if you can believe it. I don't know how they did it that fast, but they got the follow-up to Scramble out.
Yep.
It basically added more zones and difficulty and different theming. Instead of being a spaceship, you are now a Cobra helicopter. You're still doing the same thing, flying through, blowing up fuel barrels and a bunch of other stuff, but it's much more like military themed, like modern day military themed. And instead of flying through a big boss at the end and flying through it to destroy it, you loop in this game, like get to the end of the stages and start over by picking up a briefcase of cash and flying away with it, which is silly, but I love it. Other than that, though, it didn't have too many gameplay differences. And because it was apparently harder than Scramble, we figured we might just wait a bit and not play this one.
Yeah, we'd be able to see the whole first level.
Right, yeah, if we're lucky.
There were a lot of Super Cobra clones, not as many as Scramble. I don't know if they actually copyrighted the code this time or what. But we have Super Cobra by Karateko, by Sega, by Stern, by Cocomatic, by AVG, which I think is a subdivision of Zakaria.
All right, and then we have one called Jailbreak in Space by Program Power. It was a version of Cosmic Gorilla for the NASCOM system, which was a game where the aliens were trying to pick people up from the center of the screen and run away with them. And it's just an interesting choice of a port to have this on the NASCOM system.
Yeah. I don't even think they have like Galaxian on the net. So
yeah.
Like, why did you pick this one? All right, but moving in onto other computer games now, we've got one called A Tank by APX. Of course, we know what APX is. It's the user group for the Atari 8-bit computers. And this was a two-player tank game where each player controlled two tanks at the same time, which seems complicated, but okay. The terrain is destroyable, and there are also warp points around the map, which is also randomly generated. So if you like tank games, it's probably a pretty good one.
All right, and then we have Beneath the Pyramids by Crystalware. It's the Atari 8-bit version of this game that we've already taken a look at. It's sort of a adventure-style game, and it has a different layout and art style to the Apple II version, though. So pretty cool because it's on the Atari 8-bit, which we love how it looks.
Yeah, the graphics were definitely improved on that version, but we have played it before, and we got other games to play, like hockey, my next one. You might think, Ben, why are you talking about hockey when we could be playing Beneath the Pyramids?
Right, right.
But I really wanted to check this game out because I think this is maybe the first time ever in the history of video games where if you look at this game, it looks like something that would come out on the Atari 2600 or maybe the Odyssey 2. Basically, it's a home computer game that looks as good as a current home console game, which up until this point, the home console games have always been an advantage. I think if you look at the Intellivision, it doesn't look as good as that. But as far as every other home console on the market, this game, if you told me it came out for a home console, I'd be like, yeah, obviously, you know, it looks just like it. Nice. But it came out on the computer, so I thought it was a good one to cover for that reason, because these computer games are kind of catching up graphically with the home consoles, which up until this point have always had an advantage. So let's take a look at hockey. As I mentioned, it looks like something straight out of the Atari 2600 or maybe the Odyssey 2. You've got a 4-on-4 player hockey game where the hockey players are kind of stick figures, but there's a little bit of detail to them. You can tell that they've got legs, that they got arms, they're holding a hockey stick. Their heads are just squares, so it doesn't look like they have helmets on or anything like that, but they're somewhat detailed. The graphics are kind of nostalgic to me in a way. I don't know, they remind me of maybe early history of video games or just that Atari 2600 graphic style. It doesn't look like a computer game. I think maybe that's the best description of the game. You've got a white hockey playing area that you're playing on. You've got red nets and like a line beside the nets that goes to the edge. I don't think that exists in real hockey. And the puck does cross the line. You can cross the line, like go behind the net like you can in hockey. So I don't know what that line is there for. Maybe it's just to make it look good. I don't know. But otherwise, you've got a timer and a score, and that's pretty much it. The game is 2, 3, or 4 players that can play the game. So there is no, well, there's kind of AI. There's no one player mode. So like there will always be a character on the other screen that's not moving because that's meant for player two. But like if I'm playing and I'm the only human player on my team, the other characters will kind of move and do things by themselves. So I'm kind of just controlling one character for the most part. And then when I pass the puck to somebody else, I'm controlling them now. They don't really do a great job of kind of showing that, like changing the player color depending on who you're actually controlling. But it is weird that like I would play a one-player version of this game, and three of the enemy AI would kind of follow and play defense, but not all four of them, because the other one's just standing there waiting for the other player's controls. But I guess you could play up to 4 players, which on a home computer is pretty cool as well. So I guess in that case, there'd be 2 players on each team that are controlled by human, and then the other 2 are controlled by the computer. As far as how the passing and stuff works, it's kind of interesting. You have to press a direction and the shoot button. If you just press the shoot button, it's like, I don't know what you want me to do here. It doesn't do anything. So you kind of have to push the direction that you want to shoot. So oftentimes it's towards the goal, which means you're running towards the goal and shooting, which is not always the best, but you can shoot in at least 8 directions. So that's cool. I didn't think diagonals would work out, honestly, but they do. And you can pass just by shooting and having a teammate pick up the puck. You can steal the puck, just like in most hockey and soccer games. So it's got pretty much everything you'd want for hockey. Nothing like too crazy or super original. Just a very solid hockey game on the Atari 8-bit. So with that being said, let me get into my ratings. For gameplay, I ended up giving it a 3.25 out of 10. I liked it a lot. Maybe it's just nice to play a game I can win, I guess. As opposed to these space games that just like want to beat you down. But I don't know. It was a fun little challenge. I kind of played against myself, which was, you know, not the best, but I thought if you had 2 or 3 or 4, you know, 4 people total, you would have a lot of fun with this game. The games were nice and short. They were 5-minute games. And it felt like there was a decent kind of trade-off between having a defensive player kind of just run into you and you can kind of dodge them versus them just always stealing the puck when they get close. You know, there was like a nice little sweet spot there that they were able to hit, or stealing was possible but hard. And it was also just fun to shoot the hockey puck into the net. Like the goalies would try to defend, but they left enough room for the goal behind them that there was always some space. If you lined up your shot well, you could always probably get a goal. Like there was some skill there, and I didn't think it was impossible to score or anything like we have seen in other games. So I thought the gameplay was just very solid, very simple, very fun. That's kind of all you need from a hockey game. For graphics, I gave that a 2.75 out of 10. Not quite as good with the graphics here. As I mentioned, I do like them weirdly. Like they're not great, but they're simple. And they kind of just remind me of an older style of game that we don't see as much anymore. I say older style, but still like in line with Odyssey 2 games or Atari 2600 games. So I don't know, they just kind of had a nostalgic feel to the graphics. All the players do look kind of identical. They're just 2 different colors. There's a blue team and a green team, but on the white and red background, I think it really works. So I liked it. I'm not saying they're great graphics, but I like them. So 2.75 there. For sound effects, I ended up giving this a 2.5 out of 10. It's weird. There is a musical tune, which I like. It's the end of the national anthem. And then when the game starts, it's just Pong sounds for hitting the puck, but then a constant cheering noise. Like, you know, the kind of staticky cheering noise. It just happens all the time. It never stops. And it kind of does fill in the gaps because it makes the game never feel quiet. So it needed something like that. And I actually really liked most of the sound effects, honestly. I'm not saying they're great again either, but they're very doable. They sound like something that would be on a home console. So I liked it. for relevance, I just gave it a 6 out of 10 because, I don't know, I think it's maybe somewhat relevant. It's on, you know, in APX, so a lot of people could have picked this one up, but I don't know that it was a great seller just by itself. So I gave it just a 6 out of 10 because I wasn't too sure, but there are some signs that point to maybe it sold a little bit better. And overall, I gave it a 3 out of 10. I did want to get it to that 3 territory because I think this is a lot better than just a random hockey game on a random computer. It's a game that the quality of it is equal to that people are selling in physical stores. But this was like made by one guy and published by Gamma Software for the Atari 8-bit.
Right, yeah.
To me, it just felt like this is something that should be celebrated, and I wanted to mention it. Computer games are catching up, because up until now, it's kind of been like, you know, strategy games and text adventures. That's what the computer's good at. The arcade is really good with space games, and then sports games, we're seeing a lot of them on home consoles. And until now, like, I feel like we have seen them on home computers, but they're never very good.
Yeah.
But this reminds me of something that I feel like if Atari published this on the 2600, I'd be like, yeah, that looks exactly like what I would expect.
Yeah.
So I wanted to give it some props.
Yeah, no, that's definitely exciting to have a solid hockey game on a computer. And I mean, it's kind of how Atari designed the computer in the first place, right? Like, they wanted it to basically be a console. So it's nice. Opens the world to lots of possibilities when you have things like the APX program going on also, you know?
Yeah. I wonder when the computer dominance will happen, to be honest.
Yeah. That'll be interesting to see. Yeah, yeah.
maybe Commodore 64? I don't know.
That's true. That's going to be
my guess.
Make some big waves. But yeah, we'll just have to keep chugging through this timeline and see when the tide starts to turn.
Yeah.
All right, but let's move on with a few more honorable mentions here. We have Missile Command by Atari. It's the Atari 8-bit release of Missile Command, and it's a really nice port of it that runs great on the 8-bit. Not much has changed, so we're not going to cover it, but hey, cool that it's on the computer now.
And then the next one, it's pretty infamous. It's called The Soft Porn Adventure by Sierra Online. Came out on the Apple II and Atari 8-bit. We had to mention this one because we look at a lot of magazines, right, for the show, and there are so many advertisements for this game. It had to have been the number one most advertised game in 1981.
I wonder why.
And, yeah, I don't know. They were going for a certain user base, and they thought that user base was reading magazines, I guess. But it is just a normal non-graphic text adventure with adult theming, obviously. It was very popular. So I feel like I had to mention it. It was also the inspiration for Leisure Suit Larry, which is a game series that's still active today. So, you know, it's important to history, so we're covering it. But we're not going to cover it too in depth.
Right. Yeah, yeah. We'll keep it PG or PG-13 on here. All right, well, let's move on. We have one called Waterloo 2 by Crystalware, a turn-based strategy game with some visuals, but it's similar to things we've seen before, and this one came out for Apple II and Atari 8-bit. And then we also have Computer Quarterback by Strategic Simulations, which is also for the Atari 8-bit. It's a flagship title in a series of simulation computer games, but it's not really the type we're interested in. It's one of the ones where you just pick the plays and then it simulates the game. They did seem pretty popular at the time, but it's not the kind of thing that we usually like to review.
And then moving on, we've got one called Cops and Robbers on the Apple II by Sirius Software. This was a top-down adventure-style game similar to Adventure on the 2600, where you kind of play, in this case, I think you were playing as a square, going through a big multi-screened maze, so you'd kind of like leave the screen and show up on a different screen, which I do like games like that. It makes it feel like you're in a big world, so I like seeing those games, but the graphics were not very good on this one. The theming was that you were stealing from a pyramid, and so most of the enemies were mummies. So it seemed interesting, but not great. And then the last computer game here as an honorable mention today is called Sword Thrust by CE Software. This is actually made by Don Brown, the guy who made the Eman games. And it's a commercialized version of Eman, which means that he took the Eman code, which he had previously released for free, by the way, and then tried to sell it for money. So it was a really weird thing because everyone was like, why isn't this free? Like, you gave it to us for free.
Yeah.
It's weird, like, when you offer something for free and then you're like, okay, can you give me money now? Like, that's always a weird
thing. You're like, wait a second. This is actually popular. Dang it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's pretty much exactly like Eamon, and it's all text-based. There might have been some sound effects or something, but, you know, it just wasn't worth playing even at the time because you could just play the original one for free. And people were making text adventures all the time for it, so...
Right.
I do think there are going to be quite a few in this series because he tried to sell a bunch, but I don't think they really ever took off. All right, but all now right. This last game that we're going to cover, Wes, I really want to know about this one because it just looked totally wacky.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's barely even known. Lucky that we were able to find it and find it.
That's because we do the best research, Wes.
That's true. Yes. But this game is called Dinosaurs by Mark Cross. It came out sometime in 1981 for the Apple II, and we know pretty much nothing about it. We just know that it did exist, and that Mark Cross made a few other games, including one called Blitzkrieg that I believe we mentioned before. But this one is really interesting. It's actually a collection of five different mini-games, sort of games in quote, because a lot of Mark games, but I am going to talk through all of them because I was so curious, because the main game... And this was so weird. I wanted to see what all the other stuff was. So the first one that we have is Bronto in the Swamp. And it's actually just an animated little thing that plays on its own when you start the program up. It's a decent looking swamp, but you know, it's the classic Apple colors. So you can only do so much. But then a Brontosaurus goes stomping through it, looks around, walks backward a bit, and then gets ambushed by, I think, a caveman, or it could be an alien. It's really hard to tell. But then the Brontosaurus proceeds to breathe fire on the caveman, which is something that you'll notice these dinosaurs do a lot. And then the caveman eventually runs away and it just starts over and plays again. So I liked it. It's not a game, but it's just a funny little animation. The second one is called Matching Game, and it's exactly what it sounds like, where you have dinosaur images and you have to match the name of the dinosaur to the image. But it actually is pretty neat because each of the dinosaurs are sort of like have a representation of their environment. Like the Triceratops is next to a green bush that it looks like he's eating. There's a Plesiosaur that's swimming in the water. So there's actually some stuff going on there. And there's animations too, like the swimming ones move their fins a little bit and all of the standing ones kind of wag their tail back and forth. So it's like this interactive matching game. And I was very proud because I'm a dinosaur nerd, especially after playing the Ark survival games. So I got 100% on my first try.
Oh, man.
But which also meant there was no reason to ever play it again. right. But then moving on to game number three, this one was called Prehistoric Scene. And it just gives you this scenic view of a river and some trees and a volcano in the background. And then you can choose to just add in dinosaurs to the environment one by one. You can take them out. You don't have to add them all in, and you just kind of decorate the environment. You don't get to place them. They're kind of have their set locations, but you can say, I want the Tyrannosaurus Rex to show up now, and then it will show up on screen. And probably the most fun part is that after you place all the dinosaurs on the screen, you can make the volcano erupt. And I don't
Does it wipe them all out?
I don't know. I couldn't get it to happen. It might if you place more dinosaurs on screen, but I don't know. It's just a fun little thing. And also, I'm wondering if it may have been sort of an educational thing, because then you could learn all the names of the dinosaurs as you're placing them. Then we have Dinosaur Hangman, which again is pretty much exactly what it sounds, but it is funny because instead of it being classic Hangman where you're slowly drawing somebody's parts getting hung, this is a dinosaur slowly getting closer and closer to a person. And if you don't guess the word right, it'll eat the person.
Is it coming towards the camera? Like, is it eating you or is it eating some random guy?
Just some random guy. Yeah. It's like going left to right across the screen. And basically, anytime you guess a letter right, your guy shoots, I don't know, a laser or a flamethrower or something. And then the dinosaur backs up a little bit. And then once you get the word right, the dino's out of the picture. So that was fun. Just a little guessing game. And then the last game of the pack, the one that we really wanted to talk about that made us say, what the heck is going on here, is a game called Firefight. And it's real weird, but the basic concept is you are controlling a T-Rex that can move left and right, and then you can also move your head up, down, and center. And waves of Brontosaurus, Triceratops, and Pterodons all come at you, and you have to shoot fire out of your T-Rex mouth and kill them. And there's just a number at the top of the screen of how many of each one are left. They each come in sort of like lanes. So the Triceratops, you always have to aim down. The Pterodon, you always have to aim up. And the Brontosaurus, you always have to aim in the center. And the Brontosaurus also, as we learned, can shoot fire at you as well. And you have a health percentage too. And so you take damage. And then it seems like you also regenerate health as you kill the other dinosaurs. So it's really weird, but that's why we had to take a look at it. But with that overview of all the different games in the pack, let me get into my ratings now. For graphics, I actually gave it a 3 out of 10. I mean, honestly, even though the Apple II is pretty limited, there's some great visuals in this. I love all the dinosaurs that are like, they're all white on a black background, and they all have these tail wagging animations in a lot of the different games. The different scenes look pretty good too, like for the volcano scene. And then there's also a really in-depth T-Rex title screen for Firefight that looks great. The fire that you're shooting during the actual game doesn't look so good. It's just like a series of orange lines coming out of your mouth. But it does get the point across. And even though it isn't groundbreaking, I just feel like it looks really good for an Apple II game. And there's a lot of variety to it too, with all the different options of things you could play. Moving on to sounds, I give it a 1.5 out of 10 here because there are actually sounds in this. I mean, there's not many, but I'll take what I can get. There's an electronic roaring sort of sound when you shoot fire. There's a bassy noise for when you take damage, which is pretty funny. And you got these little beeps throughout to represent tail wags and dinosaurs moving around. But overall, pretty decent sound for an Apple II game. The gameplay now, that's a bit weird because we had so many different things and it's debatable if they are actually games, but Firefight is the main one I wanted to rate here because it's the most fun. And I ended up giving it a 2.5 out of 10. As a collection, I feel like all the games are pretty cool, and I'm sure a dinosaur-loving kid would have had a lot of fun with them. But on their own, they're all pretty simple. Even Firefight, you know, you're just hitting the button and aiming up and down as things go towards you. So there's still some pretty cool stuff in the pack, and I really like the idea of like learning their names and kind of using it as an educational game. And Firefight was a good bit of fun for a while, just shooting down dinosaurs with flames. How can you go wrong with that? Moving on to relevance now, though, it's hard to tell. Ben has posited the theory that maybe this is the start of the Godzilla side-scrolling genre. I think that may be a stretch, although it is definitely the first of that type of game we've ever seen. This game, though, as we mentioned, is basically unknown. You know, I don't think many people played this at all, but it's got a dinosaur shooting fire out of its mouth, so hey, it is similar in that aspect. But I don't think it probably influenced anything, so I just ended up giving it a 4 out of 10. Overall, that left me with a 2.25 out of 10. Dinosaurs is a fun little pack of games with some nice variety. Even if there wasn't too much replayability, I definitely could see like a kid who's super into dinosaurs just having tons of fun with this. And I really like the inventive use of graphics and sounds in this game. So I was so happy to take a look at it. It was just a really wacky niche game, and I always love taking a look at those.
It's interesting that we did Dino Wars not too long ago on the TRCD Coco. Like, what's going on in life where people want to make dinosaur-related fighting games? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like Jurassic Park is out yet, right? So
I have no idea. yeah, but hey, we'll take them because they're so weird.
Yeah, for sure.
But the graphics on that one were surprisingly like high detailed, like multiple colors and like shading even, like it looked really good.
Yeah. So you know, these Dino fans, they're coming out of the woodwork and they're putting in good work making these games.
They are. All right. Well, with that being said, though, Wes, I think we'll wrap it up for today. We did cover Mayday, which was a Defender clone, the first one that kind of came out after Defender and was unique by Hoei. And then you did Satan of Saturn by SNK. I did Hockey by Gamma Software. And then you did Dinosaurs by Mark Cross, which is super weird, but you can play it on archive.org whenever you want. So
yeah,
go check it out.
All right. And make sure that you keep following us on this journey. Like Ben mentioned, we got some good stuff coming, and we're just waiting to see when computer games are going to be better than consoles and maybe someday better than arcade cabinets too. Check out our website where we've got tons of great information on everything we've covered and a lot of the developers and companies. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter, or X as it's called. And man, that's going to take me a while to get used to. But that is where we post updates. And also, make sure to send us an email if you have any questions.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.